Welcome to the Blue Ocean Church Ann Arbor Lenten Podcast. I'm Emily, one of the co-pastors of Blue Ocean, and this is part 4 of 6. I'll begin by giving you a brief summary of chapter 4 of The Cross and the Lynching Tree by James Cone. I'll follow that with a couple of questions to think about during the week, and then end with a time of meditation. Chapter 4 is titled The Re-Crucified Christ in Black Literary Imagination. And Cone starts this chapter by saying, and I quote, "Many black poets, novelists, painters, dramatists, and other artists saw clearly what white theologians and clergy ignored and what black religious scholars and ministers merely alluded to, that in the United States the clearest image of the crucified Christ was the figure of an innocent black victim dangling from a lynching tree," unquote. This chapter reminds me of the book Orientalism by Edward Said, which was a landmark academic work in the late 1970s that I had to read in several of my college history courses. And in that book, Said made the case that white colonial powers painted Asians in derogatory terms that allowed them to justify having power over them. So in other words, that the way that like the British and the French and the Dutch and the Germans and so on colonized Asian countries and territories was by describing Asian people, you know, from the Near East to the Far East, describing them as backward, effeminate, weak, in need of quote-unquote civilization, and so on, in order to defend ruling those countries and taking their resources and using Asians to fight wars on behalf of the colonial powers. And the only way to prove a point like that is to show examples of it happening throughout culture. And so Said exhaustively cataloged anti-Asian imagery in Western operas, in paintings, in literature, in poems, and so on. And James Cone is making a similar move here, I think. So in order to show that black artists could see what white theologians could not, he goes through an exhaustive group of poems written by black poets, through music lyrics, through literature, through photography, and through other art. And he breezes through it all and packs it all into one chapter here. And he asks, why is it that black artists could see and express the parallels between lynching and the cross, but theologians could not? And his answer is, they lacked the imagination for it because of their own particular blind spots. He writes this, he says, "Both white theologians such as Niebuhr and black preachers throughout African American history either didn't see the parallels between the cross and the lynching tree, or else they were too fearful of the dire consequences, loss of social status, loss of work, possibly loss of life, to make that connection. In short, they lacked the imagination of the most crucial and moral kind," end quote. And Cone goes on then to describe how it takes artists of all mediums to help us break out of structures that tell us what is okay to say and what is not okay to say. He says it takes artists whose imaginations can roam freely to express what others don't allow themselves to see. And it took black artists specifically, especially those in the Harlem Renaissance, to force theologians to even entertain the idea that the cross and the lynching tree are intertwined. It took artists painting Jesus as a black man on a cross to help propel the idea of a black Christ or a black Jesus who desires liberation for all. Cone leans into all sorts of different artists. The poets and authors that he inventories include County Colon, Walter Everett Hawkins, Robert Hayden, James Andrews, Claude McKay, Lorraine Hansberry, Langston Hughes, Gwendolyn Brooks, who was the first Black Pulitzer Prize winner, W.E.B. Du Bois, Walter White, even Mark Twain, who called America the United States of Lyncherdom. So to give you a sense of the argument that Cone is making, I'll read a few lines here from two of the different poets that he discusses. So this first one is from County Colon's 1922 poem, Christ Re-Crucified, and it goes like this. "The South is crucifying Christ again by all the laws of ancient rote and rule. The ribald cries of save yourself and fool din in his ears. The thorns grope for his brain, and where they bit, Swift springing rivers stain his gaudy purple robe of ridicule with sullen red. An acid wine to cool his thirst is thrust at him with lurking pain. Christ's awful wrong is that he's dark of hue, the sin for which no blamelessness atones, but lest the sameness of the cross should tire, they kill him now with famished tongues of fire, and while he burns, good men, and women too, shout, battling for his black and brittle bones. This next one is from a 1939 poem called Burnt Offering by James Andrew, where he compares the lynching of a black man to Old Testament sacrifice. And it goes like this. A fatted calf, a priestly fire. The sacramental knife, a dire foreboding of a bloody thing. It plunges deep. Death takes its prize, and smoke ascends toward the skies. Burnt offering. A lonely tree. A surging crowd with clubs and stones and voices loud. A black man as a calf they bring. Upon a newer cross he dies, and smoke ascends toward the skies. Burnt offering. Right? It's not even subtle. The black artist held a mirror up to American faces to say, look, when you lynch people, it is like re-crucifying Jesus, who died a victim of our violence, but who was vindicated by his Father in heaven. James Cone also talks about how the suffering of the black people of America was expressed through literature, using religious metaphor. In a 1919 issue of a literary magazine called The Crisis, W.E.B. Du Bois' story, The Gospel of Mary Brown, Mary Brown cries out about her black son. She cries out this, God, you ain't fair. You ain't fair, God. You didn't ought do it. If you didn't want him black, you didn't have to make him black. If you didn't want him unhappy, why did you let him think? And then you let them mock him and hurt him and lynch him. Why? Why did you do it, God? The entire story is a retelling of the story of Jesus, only with Jesus as a young American black man named Joshua. James Cone also talks about how important visual artists both are and were in helping Americans see our actions in light of Jesus on a cross. He emphasizes the photographer James Allen's 2003 work called Without Sanctuary, which collected historical pictures of lynchings. And these historical pictures were photographs created at the sites of lynchings. They were sold for profit to white people, who then sent those pictures of lynched black people to their friends and to their families as postcards, and who kept them as souvenirs in family albums. When Cone saw the collection himself, he says this, he says, there was a hushed silence among the black and white viewers as they marched slowly, contemplating the contorted agony of black bodies dangling from trees, bridges, and lampposts. And then he says that it made him feel unsafe, seeing the smiling white people in the pictures surrounding the lynched bodies. And it made him wonder if the same white supremacy that allowed for that violence still exists, even among his white colleagues at Union Seminary. You know, we're not so far off from these lynchings. Some of them happened in my parents' childhood. I'm 41. Many of them happened within my grandparents' childhood. And I think it's more than fair to wonder what some people might do, should it be socially acceptable to do again, or given a desperate national crisis. What lies dormant beneath the veneer of social acceptability? Cone makes an observation about the artists that he describes. He says, generally, non-black artists addressed a white audience, and they focused mostly on the brutality against the black bodies and the racism of the lynchers. Black artists usually addressed the black community, and thus they tended to avoid the white brutality and the helplessness of the black victims. They focused more on black subjectivity, the dignity of the black victims, and the suffering of the black community, And he says they were much more likely to allude to the spiritual agency of black people through parallels with the suffering of Christ. Now, I think this observation can be helpful to us in reading the Bible and in understanding what messages are helpful given a particular audience. Right? People with power and agency in a given circumstance need to understand the harm being done to those who are vulnerable. Right? They need to see their own capacity for brutality. And in this case, whites needed to see white people harming a black Jesus. As to where people who have little to no power need to have their dignity affirmed. They don't need to be re-traumatized by having the violence that's been done against them rehashed and shown to them. They live it. Rather, what they need is to have their suffering validated, to receive the comforting knowledge that God suffers with them and with their community, and they need to have their human dignity and strength affirmed. And in Scripture, we most often hear the voices of the marginalized. That's the audience. And marginalized people, they cry out about their pain and their suffering, and they tell stories about their own strength and dignity. And that's the lens through which I view some of the more difficult stories of the Hebrew Bible. All right, so for instance, I think one of the hardest stories to talk about in the Bible is the story of the Canaanite genocide that's recounted in the book of Joshua. Now, we know from historical and genetic evidence that the genocide never actually took place. Many of the people of Lebanon are actually descendants of the Canaanites. So it begs the question, why is that story even in the Bible? It's an awful story. Well, the way I see it, it was written down during or just after the Babylonians destroyed Jerusalem and they took the Jewish people into captivity. And so I wonder if perhaps the story is a story about strength. It's a story about strength that an oppressed and conquered people told themselves about who they are. Right? We're not victims, we're conquerors. And that might not feel like a great explanation for such violent stories and thoughts, but I think this generally can help us understand the voices of the marginalized. Right? So for example, in our culture today, I think sometimes rap music gets critiqued for its violent themes. And I think there's a similar underlying reason for this if we can hear it. The theme is, I'm not a victim, I'm strong. And it's easy for those who are on the upside of power in a culture to critique and condemn that kind of voice without understanding the underlying sentiment, which is actually a cry of deep suffering. So then Cohn closes this chapter by talking about how difficult it is for black people to embrace the same God that the white people who have so harmed them have also embraced. Right? That the same God that whites claim gave them justification for lynching blacks is also worshipped by black people who find in Jesus a liberator. Which is why Cohn says many black Christians make a distinction between white Jesus and black Jesus. He says the white Christ gave blacks slavery, segregation, and lynching, told them to turn the other cheek and to look for their reward in heaven. Be patient, they were told, and your suffering will be rewarded, for that's the source of your spiritual redemption. On the other hand, though, the black Christ frees people from those chains. So with that summary, we're going to head into a time here where I'll just ask a couple of questions, and feel free to pause the podcast if you want to have some time to think about it or to discuss it if you're with a group. So the first question is simple. What are one to two things that you learned from this chapter? The second question is this. Where do you feel challenged, stretched, and/or provoked? Now to close out, let's take some time of silence to sit with our thoughts. So during this time, ask the Holy Spirit if there's anything that she would like to say to you into this space. And feel free to pause until you're done, and then we'll have the closing song, Strange Fruit, sung by Billie Holiday, to end the podcast.
Strange fruit. blood on the leaves and blood at the road. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar tree. Gallant South, the bulging eyes and the twisted mouth, scent of magnolia, sweet and fresh. Then the sudden smell of burning flesh. Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck, for the rain to gather, for the wind to suck, for the sun to rot, for the tree to drop. Here's a strange and bitter